Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Trump administration has moved to halt racial sensitivity training at federal agencies. The president explained why last week at the debate.
I ended it because it's racist. I ended it because a lot of people were complaining that they were asked to do things that were absolutely insane, that it was a radical revolution that was taking place in our military, in our schools, all over the place.
We're talking about sensitivity training in the age of Trump, where the practice came from in the first place, how it's changed, and how it's been politicized. Maya King covers race and demographics in the 2020 presidential race for Politico. Welcome to the show, Maya.
Thanks for having me.
When did the president get on this anti-sensitivity training bandwagon?
Well, you know, a lot of this really has its roots with Fox News and conservative media. We know that one of the more high-profile critics, conservative critics of racial sensitivity training and critical race theory, a few weeks ago went on Fox News specifically to criticize these practices and said that they didn't make much sense, that they should be ended immediately. And these were talking points, of course, that play well with Trump's base and specifically with white voters who feel like these training programs and things that pertain really to learning about this history of the country and people of color, and as it relates to racism, it infuriates them in many ways. And the president very clearly saw that, knew that his poll numbers were slipping, even with members of his base, and came out with a one-pager that essentially laid out the cancellation of a lot of these programs. And that's kind of where we find ourselves now. Last week, of course, during the presidential debate, he laid out his decisions making behind this and said that he frankly thought it was racist and that he thought it didn't make sense, and more that he thought that it was un-American and a threat to an American way of life.
He claimed that it teaches people to hate our country. What kind of evidence does he use to explain that?
Well, you know, that's the issue with this logic, is there isn't that much evidence. One scapegoat for a lot of this argument, of course, has been the 1619 Project, which cites the year 1619, of course, the beginning of slavery in the United States, as a foundational date for the United States, and makes the point that that America really has its basis and its power in racism and in enslavement. And so that's really been a scapegoat for a lot of these issues, and especially for Trump's argument that it is un-American. But it falls in line with a lot of what the president has been saying. Of course, he's called Black Lives Matter a symbol of hate. He has very clearly made himself an enemy of these movements. And in the wake of this summer of protests against racism and police violence, this is just a part of what the president and his administration have made clear for the past few months, which is that there have been protests and racism obviously is brought to the fore, but this administration is choosing to say that that's not real and that it's going against the American way of life.
How is Joe Biden responding to all of this?
Well, last week during the presidential debate, of course, the former vice president called President Trump racist and said that logic is racist. And, you know, Joe Biden and his campaign have made very clear that they are going to take a more reform-minded approach to systemic racism and police violence in this country. But what they're absolutely not going to do is abolish or seek to censor any issues of critical race theory or any topics that relate to the legacy of racism in the United States.
You know, you've referred to critical race theory a few times. Could you give us a thumbnail on what that is?
Sure. Well, you know, I don't have necessarily a very academic definition.
All the better. Go ahead.
But what I do know is that a lot of really what it lays out, of course, is the legacy of racism in the United States and topics like microaggressions, white privilege, ideas of race and how people of different races in this country have related to one another and the ways that it's been detrimental to certain groups. And this is a big threat, I mean, to the president's base and to a lot of his talking points that really center on white grievance politics. My colleagues and I wrote a story about this last week that lays it out. And again, getting back to what this really appeals to, of course, is the president's base and critical race theory is not something that really plays well with them right now.
You know, I heard his speech in Minnesota. I didn't hear the section, or it didn't resonate with me, at least when I was listening to it. But I do remember him bringing up genetics a lot.
And
you all have good genes. And I was looking out at the audience and it was primarily white.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is it's a touchy talking point. And of course, it reminds me very much of really Nazi Germany and these talking points about building an Aryan nation. And that's what his critics have also laid out, which is that not only is this incorrect and inappropriate, but frankly, that it's dangerous. And I think that's what the former vice president was saying during the debate last week when he was able to make the argument, which is just that these are talking points that are racist. And that the president is very clearly making himself out to be a racist figure and a polarizing figure on race.
We are talking about racial sensitivity training today. The president has denounced it as anti-American and racist. Joining me right now to kind of lay the groundwork, Maya King. She covers race and demographics in the 2020 presidential race for Politico. The directive to end sensitivity training in federal agencies was issued in early September by way of a memo from the Office of Management and Budget. What are the specifics of it? I mean, does this all cease and desist immediately?
Well, it's been kind of a slow drip, but over the last few weeks, I think we've seen a very just rapid pace of these programs ending. We know that a lot of the programs and even talking conferences that related to race that a lot of federal agencies were slated to host have been suddenly canceled. Even internal book clubs have also been canceled for employee activities at the Department of Education. And this is something that spans a number of agencies and a number of programs as it relates just to the ways that this country operates. You know, it's the federal government, but it's all of the federal government agencies. And the ways that, you know, this could really impact and have a serious trickle down effect on regular, just everyday Americans and the ways that they engage with race and the ways in the workplace.
How have federal employees reacted? What's been the reaction in the rank and file? Do you know?
Well, I haven't spoken to too many rank and file federal agency employees. Though I think that the reaction is very mixed from what I understand. There are those, of course, who feel like this is just one less thing to worry about, yet there's, of course, the very obvious concern that this will create a less safe environment for a number of people, specifically people of color and women in the workplace, that there's no safeguards in place to actually lay out the ways that, you know, certain behaviors can really be harmful to groups of people.
He later extended the ban to federal contractors. Did they explain what the consequences would be for companies that work with the federal government if they continue providing sensitivity training sessions? And is that even legal?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is such an in the weeds and a very sudden decision to make. And the way that it's come down, I mean, this is a clear pattern with this administration where they make these decisions that are very kind of gut punches, but then the actual enforcement of these policies is really murky. I think, of course, though, from what I know about the way this administration operates and the ways that, you know, punishments have been laid down, I imagine this will be very much working with not only just the administration, but also conservative watchdogs. We saw last week a conservative activist actually pointed out a program that I believe the Department of Education was going to host that related to race. And as soon as they pointed it out, the program was canceled. So I imagine this is a pattern that will continue to take place. And for those who try to disobey it, I mean, it's likely a loss of employment.
But I'm also thinking of like contractors that aren't federal agencies. They're contracted to do work with the government. How can he control what they want their internal environment to be like?
Yeah, I mean, it will probably be a very bureaucratic enforcement of this. And I think, you know, this will, again, rely on his allies on lower levels to actually point out and enforce these enforce this new measure.
An NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll this summer found that two-thirds of Americans believe the president has made race relations worse. So I'm wondering, from where you stand covering the 2020 presidential race, what's the White House strategy here? Is it just to cement relations with his constituency, such as it is, already, or what? Is it going to grow the constituency or the voter base?
That's a real question. I mean, you know, we know that the 2020 election in many ways is a referendum on race and race relations in this country. The president's base has really shrunk in the last few months. While it used to be shored up by white women, by older white voters, by white men, a lot of these groups have actually kind of drifted away from the president as his rhetoric on or his policies really on race have become more polarizing. And so I think with policies like this and talking points, both at the state and his executive orders and even through his surrogates on the campaign trail and on programs on Fox News, I mean, this is all an effort to try to stitch together what's left of, you know, the most enthusiastic members of his base. And talking points like this do play well with them. However, that group is getting smaller and smaller. Just as you mentioned, two-thirds of Americans really feel like the president has worsened race relations. So if you're appealing just to the one-third who are actually who disagree with that or even might be in favor of a president who is racially polarizing, that's not a winning coalition.
Is the GOP at large supportive of these policies?
Well, outwardly, we know that few top party members have really come out to condemn the president's talking points. Yet, you know, Senate Republicans have certainly gotten more nervous about this. You know, the Senate is just a few seats away from Democratic control. Mm-hmm. And when the president is making these points, I mean, with swing voters and those who are on the fence, it's really not helping their cause. And so we've seen in the last few weeks more senators who are in kind of sensitive seats saying, you know, I don't agree with what the president said. I think he misspoke. But I also believe that he should, you know, rephrase and come out and try to clean this up, not just for his sake, but for theirs.
Is there any response from, say, the Senate or the House? I mean, does the House have to follow this order, or is that outside the purview of, quote unquote, federal agencies?
No, I don't think the Senate or the House will have to follow these issues, especially as they continue to try to push for policies that, you know, go directly against it. You know, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act is something that I believe that the House has passed, but the Senate, you know, is sitting on. However, if it were to pass the Senate, I suppose, you know, given the president's record and his talking points in these last few weeks before the election, it's not something that he would be interested in signing into law.
And just to get back to the 1619 Project from the New York Times, that won the Pulitzer Prize, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a phenomenal, you know, it's an incredible project that they put together. We devoted 1 hour. You could have devoted 10 hours to it in its depth and breadth. And we'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. The president has threatened federal funding to schools who continue to teach using the 1619 curriculum from the New York Times. What kind of power does he have over doing that?
Well, that's unclear to me, at least, in understanding exactly what role the president or the executive branch can really play in limiting school curriculum. And, you know, what's important to remember about the 1619 Project is that all of it is rooted in history.
Right.
This is not just an editorial or, you know, a piece that is an opinion piece. I mean, this is truly going back more than 400 years to look at the origins of this country and what it's built upon. And of course, I mean, these are very uncomfortable truths, right? You know, the fact that slavery and systemic racism have really built up not just the social hierarchy of this country, but also the economic power of the United States. And these are truths that really have not been taught very widely in a number of schools, which is part of the reason why the 1619 Project has been able to incorporate it into a curriculum. And I think that, frankly, you know, the Trump administration views this as a very threatening thing, because when you start to talk about race and racism and examine that through the lens of a number of the things that this president has said, you know, it doesn't bode well for him or even his supporters.
Well, Maya King, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it, and best wishes covering the race and demographics in the 2020 presidential race.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
You bet. That's Maya King. She covers race and demographics in the 2020 presidential race for Politico. Coming up, we're going to drill down a little deeper and hear some pros and cons of so-called sensitivity training, racial sensitivity training, critical race theory, and more. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Trump administration last month moved to end racial sensitivity training that he has called divisive and un-American. The president later expanded the ban to federal contractors, tweeting that, quote, Americans should be taught to take pride in our great country, end quote. We're taking a closer look at what diversity training is and is not and why it's needed. Hassan Kwame Jeffries is Associate Professor of History at Ohio State, where he teaches courses on civil rights and black power movements. Welcome back, Hassan.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Mary Morton is president of the Morton Group. That's a consulting firm that conducts sensitivity training for government agencies, companies, and nonprofits across the country. Welcome, Mary Morton.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Mary, how does sensitivity training work? I mean, is there a general thumbnail you could give us of how the training is usually conducted?
Well, I can certainly tell you how we do it at Morton Group. Mm-hmm. And we generally start with an assessment. So we don't walk into an organization and just say, we're going to do a training for you. We're not bringing a training that we have conducted with another organization. And so the assessment tells us what we need to really explore in the training sessions. They can range anywhere from 3 to 6 hours. We don't go much longer at this point, being doing everything virtually, and we work with the course groups all over the country. And during those training sessions, they are interactive. We use breakout groups. We set up scenarios. We just do a variety of things to make sure that people understand some of the history of what bias has looked like in this country, of what power and privilege has looked like in our country. And then we end those sessions generally by some action planning. How can you take what you've learned in this session and start to center it, to embed it, if you will, in your organization? And so generally there's, as I said, an assessment. And then we really drill down on some of the topics you've already discussed with your previous guests. We look at power and privilege. We look at bias. We look at microaggressions. However, what we do for each organization is really customized based on what we learn in the assessment.
How do you conduct an assessment in the first place?
Sure. Well, we conduct our assessment by a variety of data collection tools. So in most cases, that's going to include surveys. We're going to do individual interviews, and we might also do focus groups. It depends on what the client partner really thinks makes sense. And in consultation with us, we come up with a plan. And so we will survey every single person in the organization, and then we will interview a select number, a sampling of individuals in the organization. Really want to look at the different stakeholder groups, if you will. Uh-huh. And then we, as I said, may conduct focus groups as well. And we work in consultation, very close partnership with the client partner. We collect all this data, we analyze it, and then we write an assessment report, which is presented to our client partner. And that really provides the roadmap, if you will, for not only the workshops, but the work that follows these training sessions, because the training sessions, I have to tell you, are just really, in some cases, a checking of the box, if you will. Huh. It is what you do with the work, you know, what you've learned. What are you going to do now? Because just taking a workshop doesn't necessarily change anything.
And then over the years that you've been doing this, and I'm not quite sure how long you have been, but I know you're very experienced. How has sensitivity training changed? Has it much, or has it always been pretty much the same thing?
Oh, no, it's definitely changed. Okay. When so Morton Group, we're 19 years old this year.
Okay.
And pardon me, we've always done what was for many years called diversity work, right? Mm-hmm. How do we raise up difference? How do we welcome people that are different? I would say in maybe less than 10 years or so, we've really started to move toward diversity, equity, and inclusion, mm-hmm. and in some cases, really racial equity workshops. And the difference is that while we hear many groups talk about D&I, sometimes when I ask a corporate partner, where's your equity? You know, how are you talking about equity? They will say, well, that's incorporated under inclusion, right? Diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And what we think is most important to share is that, inclusion is important, right? It means that I was invited to the party and someone asked me to dance. However, what we know ultimately means life-changing differences for folks is equity. Mm-hmm. How do we make sure that people have the resources and the access that they need to be successful? We used to talk about equality, and that's another thing that's changed. We all want to be equal. Well, the reality is we don't all start equal. We don't all start in the same place. So therefore, equity is really what we're trying to work toward and what we want to achieve. And that's very different than just talking about difference, which is what diversity is.
And Hassan Kwame Jeffries, equity is what the question of equity and what it means is what brings us to the history of biases, power, and privilege that Mary Morton just referred to.
That's true, because not only have we lived in a society that has not treated people equally, we have lived in a society that has not had equity for people. And this isn't something that is new. This isn't something that is made up. This is something that is the American experience. And if we want to teach honestly the truth about the past as well as the present, then we have to not only recognize that inequality and the absence of equity has been a major theme for all Americans in terms of no matter which side of that equity line that they have been on, but that it has shaped the trajectory of the nation from its founding in the 1600s to the present.
You know, there's a thing, Mary Morton, and of course, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, chime in that we're kind of getting down to the marrow here, and that's why people are resisting. So it's not just, it's about taking responsibility and about being part of the solution instead of just not being an active force of dissonance. But be actually taking ownership of the history lessons that are out there and the truth, I was talking about them with Maya King from Politico, and owning it. And that seems to be, I mean, it's going beyond touchy-feely, making you feel
Absolutely.
Better about it. And so I'm wondering if calling it sensitivity training, how do you even feel about that phrase these days?
Well, I have to say, we don't refer to it in that way.
Okay.
We refer to it as creating cultures of equity. That's the title, actually, of one of our workshops.
Okay.
We do have an intro to anti-racism 101, but we don't call it sensitivity training. And what is important, and we say this to all of our client partners when we start our work, is that this work is difficult and it's going to be uncomfortable. And only with the discomfort will we see any real change. I mean, think about social movements.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Have we seen any social movement that was successful that did not have people in the streets literally protesting? No.
Mm-hmm.
And so this work means that you're going to have to do some of your own personal work, as well as the work that you're trying to move forward in your own organization. That's uncomfortable. It means that there has to be a shift in power. And most leaders have difficulty really internalizing what that's going to mean. And people are worried that they're going to lose something by doing this work. It certainly shines a light on, as you mentioned, sort of past discrimination and bias and exclusion. And people are very uncomfortable with that. But that's when we know the work is actually happening, when there is discomfort.
Yeah, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, I mean, what about in your work covering the movements, the you know, the civil rights movement, for example, is a really good example. But there are many others. Whenever the issue of race becomes part of the question, there is there's a whole power thing going on that makes me wonder, how do you know anything's really changing the hearts of people?
Well, you know, when I see it in my students, when my mm-hmm. students come to my classes, whether civil rights or African-American history from film, and they've gone through our traditional American education system, they don't know this history. Mm-hmm. And then when I present to them just basic facts right. about the past, you know, they wind up literally going through the five stages of grief, right? It's mm-hmm. denial, it's anger, mm-hmm. it's depression, it's trying to, you know, bargain out of it. And so, you know, I see them walk through this, but in the end, I want them to move them from not knowing to knowing, mm-hmm. because as Mary Moyen had pointed out, at the end, it's about action. But you can't take action if you don't know what action to take, and you don't know what action to take if you don't know what the issues are. And so it's not so much. I mean, there is an empathy. There is a portion of it that touches emotion, and it is about empathy and being able to connect with people. But for me, it's really about knowledge and knowing. Mm-hmm. And then what are you going to do with that knowledge once you have it? That's the action. That's where we need people to be in the end.
I think that, you know, being raised, you know, growing up in the 60s, like I did, and being taught what I was taught, I can very specifically remember a social studies book or a chapter in a social studies book when I was in like the sixth grade or the fifth grade or something that talked about progress. And the big example they used were the expressways that were built, you know, the Eisenhower system, right? Mm-hmm. And but never did we ever learn, and never did it occur to me till I was old that it also ruined entire neighborhoods and shredded the social fabric of so many African-American communities across the country. And I think Mary Moyen is that. I mean, it's kind of a prosaic example, but it's the one that I guess kind of I felt like they made us feel very proud of our country with those lessons.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great example, actually, of not understanding the impact of what's happened from what many people would assume is progress, right?
Yeah.
We're getting an expressway, but not understanding what it was doing to the actual community. And those kinds of measures have been taken for years. In some cases, they were actual laws. You know, we think about redlining. We mm-hmm. think about the GI Bill. There are many, many instances in history, which I'm sure it's covered in Kwame's class, that people just don't know. And so they don't even understand the possibility. They don't understand the contributions that people that look like them have made. And to not have that information when you're growing up in a world where you understand what it means, for instance, right now to be a young Black man, but to not know what has been done before you ever arrived, and to know that there are extraordinary possibility models in the world around us, but we don't know about them. We have no understanding of them. And so we can't see ourselves in those roles because we don't even know that we had some of those roles to begin with. And so understanding the history is very important if we want to really have a clear indication of where we want to go in the future. It can't be stated enough how important the work that happens in the school systems are.
Right. And then, you know, so much of it for those of us who didn't get any of that then, to be having the training later on in life or something, does it have the same sort of impact, Hassan? Or what are your thoughts about this kind of later life education of the system?
It's never too late to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And right. It's never too late to actually mm-hmm. improve. So, no, I mean, I see the same reaction in my 18-year-olds, as I see in folk who are 75 and 80, it is important, no matter how old we are or where we are in life or what our profession is, that we understand the way in which our society not only operates but has operated, so that we can understand how people's lives are impacted by decisions of the past and decisions in the present. And it isn't about sort of laying blame on anybody. There's nobody alive today who's responsible for the enslavement of my ancestors. That's not the issue. But what's critically important for all of us to understand, especially as educators and as parents, is that our children in particular, not responsible for the past, not responsible for the present, but they are responsible for the future. They are responsible for dealing with the problems that we have created, that we're laying at their feet. And the only way to prepare them to address those issues going forward is if we have prepared them to understand the present and the past.
All right. So I wanted to get, you know, some feedback from both of you, Miriam Morton, you first about this president's banning of this kind of training in federal agencies and with federal contractors, no less.
Well, I think it's not necessarily surprising because we have an administration that has not done anything to support people really understanding what it means in terms of living in a racist country. And so it feels like more of the same. I think for our work, we just completed trainings with our state office, our governor's office here in Illinois, their executive staff, and they're taking this very seriously. And I recall reading about the executive order as we were wrapping up our trainings and thinking, what if these trainings weren't happening at the state level? And now to know that they might not be happening at the federal level mm-hmm. is quite concerning, because we know there's going to be a domino effect, if you will. There's going to be a trickle down effect, and that it will impact how the actual staff do their jobs, and it will impact the kind of services that people receive, and it will have a trickle down effect. So it is very concerning. We're committed to continuing to do this work with those who are willing and ready to do it. And we think that even as organizations take on this work, sometimes they're worried about doing it. They'll say, we're worried about losing donors. And we have to remind them that there are many people that are waiting for you to do this work, and there are many people waiting for you to join in with you because you are doing the work.
Mm. And Hassan Kwame Jeffries?
Yeah, you know, I think part of the fear is less, you know, well, it's just as much not only what Trump can actually do with a particular executive order, and there are limits to what he can actually do, but it's the signaling, it's the messaging mm-hmm. That this type of work isn't necessary, and in fact, that this type of work does harm as opposed to doing good. And people pick up on that. They pick up on it in the corporate world. They pick up on it in state government. And sadly, they'll pick up on it in our public educational institutions. And that is really, really concerning and really frightening because, you know, we've done a lot of good. We've done a lot of good work. Folks like Mary Morton are continuing to do that work, but we got a long way to go. Mm-hmm. And rather than pausing, we're actually rolling back. And that's really troubling.
Well, I guess I kind of think about the Hegelian dialectic, I suppose, you know, thesis, synthesis, antithesis. So there's this logic, this not logical, but this pushback, which as the country expanded its education, you know, a la 1619 Project and that sort of thing, it was inevitable that there was going to be a pushback. Right, Mary Morton?
I would agree with that, right? That makes sense. However, I think that we've had an awakening and I would like to think it is a transformation. Mm-hmm. I think we are seeing something different than we've seen before. And certainly we see people, to Hassan's point, that really are impacted by this work. We have stories of people who said, this has changed my life. Like, I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. And these are folks who are people of color and people who are also white. This has changed my life, and it really gives me direction on how I need to move forward in really being equitable and really understanding that I have done some things that maybe intentionally were not, you know, racist, but they, in fact, that was the impact. They were racist. And so to understand that work, people are transformed by it.
Well, Mary Morton, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Mary Morton is president of the Morton Group. It's a national consulting firm that conducts sensitivity training, although she doesn't use that phrase, for government agencies, companies, and nonprofits across the country. Of course, we're talking about all of this because the Trump administration last month moved to end racial sensitivity training that he's called divisive and un-American. Coming up, we're going to hear from someone who has their own thoughts about diversity training. He's from a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. So stay with us. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about President Trump's order last month to end federal employee racial sensitivity training. The Trump administration has labeled such training, quote, un-American propaganda. Still with us is Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's associate professor of history at Ohio State. And also joining us, Mike Gonzalez. He's a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. His new book is titled The Plot to Change America, How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Ann, thanks a lot for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on with you and with Professor Jeffries.
You have called critical race theory, quote, an unremitting attack on all the norms, traditions, and institutions of American society. I get that critical race theory kind of unpacks a lot of those things and explains them in terms of the enslavement of humans, but how is it an attack on the norms and traditions and institutions?
So I called critical theory an unremitting attack on American norms and traditions. Critical race theory is an offshoot of critical theory. So critical theory was a concept that was enunciated by Max Horkheimer of the Frankfurt School in a book in 1936. Mm-hmm. And it really was a way to criticize all aspects of the West. And they came to America. They zeroed in on America. They did not criticize the USSR. They did very little, but they really concentrated on the United States. And that is something that is carried on to today. Today, obviously, we have critical race theory. We have critical legal theory. Mm-hmm. We have critical pedagogy. And they all do this the same approach in all these different departments.
And so, what's wrong with it? Yeah.
Well, what is wrong with it is it's something aimed to destroy, to replace the storyline of America, what they would call the hegemonic narrative. It's at bottom, it says there is no truth. There's only one narrative versus another narrative. It's very relativist, and there are truths. History happened in the way it did, and we should face history squarely. We should say that we had slavery. Here are the consequences. Here's Frederick Douglass. Here's what he said. Here's Thomas Jefferson in Madison, and writing the Declaration and the Constitution. We should. Truth happened. So it's not just a narrative that is to be replaced with a counter narrative.
Okay, so I used an example earlier in the program that I'll share with you where I grew up in the 60s learning that all the expressways that they built, you know, the Eisenhower system was a great source of pride and a sign of progress, but later in life learned that it also destroyed hundreds of communities across the country in the process. That doesn't take away, I mean, can you use that example to explain what you're talking about?
No, that is looking at history again, and looking at new material and saying, oh, well, here are the consequences of what happened.
Uh-huh.
You didn't know the consequences in the 60s. Now they're more evident. So that is the way. That is just a normal way. What Horkheimer would have called traditional theory, looking at things with objectivity. Critical race theory and critical theory say objectivity does not exist.
That there's always self-interest.
Yeah, right. There's always self-interest. There's no way that it's not even an attempt to be objective. But I think I really want to get back to the original subject, what I thought we were going to be discussing, which is these anti-racism training, so-called anti-racism training, and why they're so harmful. Because I do support what the president did, very much so. I would like to really discuss that aspect.
All right. Well, what do you think is so bad about trying to teach people what racism is and teaching them that it's bad?
Well, that's not the way I would put it. So I'm going to challenge that premise.
All right.
I would say that these trainings are divisive. They are racist in themselves. Very racist, in fact. They are a form of workplace harassment, and they're going to lead to many suits to come. They're very costly. One diversity trainer, Howard Ross, made $5 million from the federal government alone.
Okay, that's a dollars and cents thing, and I get that that's a piece of this. But
that's impressive.
I know, but we don't have that much time. I wonder, what is divisive about them? What is harassing about them?
It says people against each other. It says we have two groups. We have several groups that are subjugated, the oppressed. We have this other group that are the oppressors. They have inherited guilt. They have collective guilt. They cannot expiate that guilt. That is incredibly divisive. I mean, it's also very – there are many things wrong with this. And there's no evidence that it works. In fact, there have been studies conducted by people at Harvard and Columbia with hundreds of companies. They show there's no impact to this whatsoever. So it's not only costly, and when schools do it, that's what – this money, these scarce resources could be going into books, computers, things to actually help kids, especially poor kids. No, it's going into the pockets of a class of people who come in and give these trainings that really is a waste of money.
Well, let me ask you this, Mike Gonzalez, do you even think that there's something to change? In other words, if all these trainings go away, does they not get replaced with anything else? Is there nothing that needs, to be reviewed as adults and in the workplaces, the inequities, that kind of a thing, the microaggressions, all of that, that just stays the same or what?
Well, the consultants conducting these trainings, they definitely should not be doing this. I would have to look at, I can't answer a theoretical question because I haven't looked at another form of training that you can come up with. I think what I can definitely say is enforce the law. It is illegal to discriminate. It is illegal to harass somebody. It is illegal to harass somebody because of his or her race.
But what if you don't even know what the harassment? But what if in these trainings they teach you what harassment is and you didn't realize you were doing it before that?
But that's not what they're doing. They're saying that punctuality is a white concept.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, go ahead.
I got to jump in.
Yeah, sure.
The reality is what they're saying isn't real. They're saying racism isn't real. But this is also coming from the same group of people who are saying science isn't real, who are saying Russian interference isn't real, who are saying the coronavirus isn't real, who are saying global warming isn't real.
What's divisive,
let's just be clear, what's divisive isn't a training to point out the ways in which people are committing harm against other folks, both individually and collectively as a part of systems. What's divisive is racism itself. And so this whole notion that bringing up the problems that we confront that impact people's lives and saying that that's somehow just a Ponzi scheme to put money in people's pockets is not only insulting, it in and of itself is divisive and is doing harm. So let's just be clear about that. And when we're talking about these notions of critical race theory, and Ann, you gave a great example of the Eisenhower interstate system, right? And Mr. Gonzalez, your response was what? They didn't know that at the time that it was having a disparate impact on people. That's the problem right there. They specifically identified Black and brown communities to build these highways through, purposefully destroying them to preserve white middle class and upper middle class communities. I'm not done yet. That's the issue. That's the problem. And we can look at it in the 1950s. We can look at it in the 1750s. Because the same things that you're talking about, this idea of education and anti-racism training, we look at the American past, and I'm an educator. When we look at the American past and we look at something like slavery, like, oh, yeah, slavery existed. But you're going to pretend as though slavery was some kind of American side hustle, that James Madison, the architect of the Constitution, that this was just some side gig he did that wasn't really central to his life. It wasn't. He was a third generation enslaver. Slavery is central. Racism is central to the founding and formation of this country. And to deny it is to put blinders on and to continue to perpetuate this Disney version of history that does nothing for people in the present.
Mike Gonzalez?
So, yeah, a lot of things were put in my mouth that were never said, but I'll tell you what is insulting. It's to say that punctuality is a white concept. No, people who work together need to rely on each other. To say the love of the written word is the product of whiteness, that is completely toxic. To say that rationality is whiteness. No, rationality is the faculty that makes us humans. It's what all 7 billion of us on this earth share in common and gives us humanity. These are all things that I'm saying. They all come from so-called anti-racism training. They say hard work is the product of whiteness. That is insulting, okay? That is what is insulting. Individualism is not white. The concept of individual rights is what gives men and women dignity from Bangalore to Brazil. All these things that I have just said come straight from the trainings that these consultants do that have been banned. This is why it was so essential that they be banned.
What about the 1619 Project, Mike Gonzalez, and the president's dissatisfaction with that as well, a Pulitzer Prize-winning project out of the New York Times, noting and dissecting the history of enslavement 400 years ago in the United States?
Well, the project did not get the prize. Nicole had an essay on the project that got the Pulitzer Prize. That itself was an outrage. It is filled with inaccuracies. They're going back and rewriting it. They keep changing. The central tenet that the colonists fought the revolution because they were afraid that the British Empire was going to take away slavery, that they had to go back into. No, that wasn't a cost. Another charge that was made.
You know, we have really, really bad connection, Mike Gonzalez. Is there something you've done different?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay, so I'll repeat that. One of the central tenets of the 1619 Project was that the colonists waged war on Britain because they were afraid that Britain was going to take slavery. That has been now, the New York Times has said, no, we got that wrong. That is not one of the central causes of the revolution. Another one was that the country started in 1619, not in 1776. And Nicole Hannah-Jones is now coming back and saying, oh, I never said that, despite many tweets in parts of the project.
Enslavement was brought to the continent in 1619.
No, it wasn't. Slavery was brought to the continent by Ponce de Leon in 1526, okay. Brought it to Florida.
Okay, yeah, Hassan Kwame Jeffries, yeah.
Because, of course, we know that the Atlantic slave trade predated the arrival of the English to the British colonies. 1619 marks the moment where English colonists, which would be the forebearers for what would become the United States, mm-hmm. bring slavery here. And so by pointing to Ponce de Leon and to the broader Atlantic slave trade, essentially what they're trying to do is to absolve Americans, what would become America, of responsibility. They are, whether it's the founders of the nation in 1776, they're making conscious decisions to maintain and perpetuate the institution of slavery all throughout. And so this effort to absolve America somehow of not just its original sin, but of its origin, the key economic institution that enables the colonies to thrive and expand, what revolutionaries are fighting to preserve and protect is their economic interest. Whether you want to call that preserving slavery or not, or who they were worried about, they were determined to preserve and protect it, and not only fought a war to it, but then enshrine protections for it in the founding document. That's not making anything up, Mr. Gonzalez. That is
that is making a lot up. That is making
everything
up.
That's not making anything up.
Yeah, no, you're making everything up.
No.
All the major founders wrote against slavery. They found slavery barbaric.
Mike Gonzalez, that's just flatly not true. I mean,
No, that is true.
They owned slaves.
No, yes, Washington, Jefferson, they did own slaves. These are contradictions that men have. They did say Jefferson wrote against slavery, Madison wrote against slavery. They all found it objectionable.
But they participated in it, Mike Gonzalez. I mean, of course, we could dissect, and I would love to just sit and dissect this stuff all day long. But I only have a minute left, and I at this point have to say thank you. And Mike Gonzalez, I really appreciate your time. I really want to have you back to talk about this some more. Mike Gonzalez is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. His book is titled "The Plot to Change America: How Identity Politics is Dividing the Land of the Free." It was published in July. And Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at Ohio State University. Hassan Kwame Jeffries, thanks so much for your time. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is not a done deal. We will continue the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.